I'm pretty sure Walmart couldn't have scripted this one any better.
I'd also like to highlight the announcement this morning from Walmart. We want to thank them.
No, thank you, Mr. Secretary. From American Public Media, this is Market Plans. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, January 11th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, when the world's biggest private employer speaks, people listen, even or perhaps especially the White House. This morning, as you've heard, Walmart announced it's going to give some of its hourly workers a one-time bonus of as much as $1,000. It's going to bump starting wages to $11. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin had no qualms, though, about taking credit for it.
Walmart is the latest company to make such an announcement, directly result of the Tax Cuts Act, and they join over 130 other companies across the nation who have already given such relief. We're now up to over 2 million workers that have seen either special bonuses or additional wages.
To be fair, Walmart is so big that until the announcement this morning, it was 1 million people in this economy who'd gotten the bonuses. We called Abigail Wozniak, professor of economics at Notre Dame, to see whether the GOP tax plan is going according to plan. Professor Wozniak, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
As you heard the Treasury Secretary there, this is kind of what the administration and the Republicans had in mind when they said, listen, this money is going to get out into the economy, into workers' hands, right? This is it.
This is what they had in mind. I'm curious as to whether they expected it to come so fast, but I think certainly this is what they expected, yes.
Walmart is by far the largest, but other big companies have done similar things. Most of the other companies, though, in fact, all of them virtually, have done bonuses instead of the wage gains that Walmart is doing. Talk to me about the one-off effect of this being a bonus rather than a continuous increase in salaries.
Sure. I mean, as you mentioned, the big difference is that a bonus is something companies pay on a year-to-year basis, whereas once you raise worker wages, a foundational empirical fact in labor economics is that it's very hard to reduce workers' nominal wages. So companies are just much less locked in if they pay a bonus this year versus if they actually raise wages.
And there is no expectation necessarily of a bonus next year because virtually all these companies also have said, listen, we're doing this because of the tax bill.
Right. That's what they've said. So I guess I'm a little confused about that argument because I think, again, like you pointed out at the beginning, the goal of the tax plan is to generate, I think, somewhat greater than one-off growth. I mean, certainly far greater than one-off kind of annual bonuses. So I think the vision was that this would put enough cash in companies' pockets and create this kind of longer-term windfall that they could then use to raise wages and expand their companies long-term. So I don't think the goal of the plan was to have this be a one-off kind of thing. It's more possible that companies are needing to get additional incentives out there to get workers in the door and perhaps to retain the workers that they have in a very tight labor market. Paying bonuses is a way to do that. Certainly, as Walmart is doing, raising wages for new hires is another way to get folks in the door. And it may be this is something companies actually need to do right now, and it makes sense to kind of advertise that they're doing something that's very much in line with the administration's goals.
Right. Well, that's where I was going to go. The labor market is tightening, and we've been talking about that on this show for years and years. There is some upward wage pressure now. Walmart, in fact, raised its hourly wage to $10 a couple of years ago. So this was, in a way, sort of in the cards anyway.
Right. And when they did raise wages a couple of years ago, they also advertised that this was in line with administration priorities. We were in the Obama administration at that time, but very much that you heard almost identical language coming out of the company at that time. So I think it makes complete business sense. They're a savvy company to advertise when you are doing something that's in line with goals that, you know, a large set of our elected officials are trying to achieve. So I think that's part of what we're seeing here.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, and it obliges a somewhat cynical question, which is these companies, specifically the companies now that are doing this in the wake of this tax cut, are in a way playing to the crowd, playing to the political crowd.
Potentially. I mean, I felt a little bit better about it today as an economist, because this is what we expect companies to do, right? This is to their advantage. They need to raise wages. You might as well get all the bang out of that that you can. And I guess economists at least will rest easy that businesses still behave that way.
Well, if economists feel better, then I guess we all feel better, right? Abigail Wozniak, she's a professor of economics at Notre Dame. Professor Wozniak, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Got to add here, just in the interest of context, that Walmart also announced layoffs today. The company closed, apparently without notice, about 10% of its Sam's Club stores. It's about 63 stores. Wall Street today, what? Traders worry? We'll have the details. The answer is no, by the way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a big change in healthcare policy today. The White House said that for the first time, it is going to let states impose work requirements on some people who get benefits under Medicaid. 10 states so far have submitted the paperwork to be allowed to require healthy working-age adults on Medicaid to have a job, to volunteer, or to be in school. Those states say the goal is to help people move into steady work and, in doing so, make Medicaid smaller and save money. But Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from the Health Desk at WHYY. Those states are rolling the financial dice a little bit.
In its waiver request, New Hampshire would have people in the first 12 months work or be in some kind of training 20 hours a week.
The second year, that requirement would go up to 25 hours. And after the second year, that requirement would go up to 30 hours per week.
Greg Moore is with the conservative advocacy group Americans for Prosperity. The goal, says Moore, get people into jobs, and that would save money.
Over time, this will be a tremendous benefit to the taxpayers just because there'll be fewer people who are on public assistance.
It's unclear how many people we're talking about. The Kaiser Family Foundation estimates already 60% of non-elderly people on Medicaid work. Make no mistake, these requirements, as well as other skin-in-the-game provisions like co-pays and time limits, are intended to provide financial relief to states. But here's the thing, says Kaiser Family Foundation's Diane Rowland.
It's not clear that when you remove someone from the Medicaid rolls, the cost of taking care of that person disappear.
Of course, just because people are swept off the rolls doesn't mean their health care needs go away. Like the guy with diabetes who drops off the program only to show up at the ER needing an amputation because he didn't have access to care. But Ben Summers, a physician and health economist at Harvard, says even with some new costs like this, states come out ahead.
Overall, reducing enrollment tends to save money.
Certainly a financial win, but Summer says it's harder to say that if you think of healthcare as an investment in producing a healthier population. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The Internal Revenue Service released something called updated withholding tables today. It sounds like a tax policy snoozer, I know, but it is a big deal, and here's why. Remember, President Trump promised when he signed the tax plan into law last month that people would see their paychecks go up as a result. He specifically said, actually, in February, as in next month. If that's going to happen, though, payroll administrators need to know how much to withhold from your paycheck, hence the buzz over withholding tables. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
It's a delicate balance, paycheck tax withholdings. Take too much out, you get less cash in the bank, but a nice refund at tax time. Take out too little, more take-home pay, but a bill when taxes are due. Usually, the withholding tables are updated every year with little fanfare, says Mark Mazur of the Tax Policy Center.
It's not that difficult to update the withholding tables and formulas in a normal year when all you're doing is adjusting for inflation and changing tax parameters from year to year.
But this year, he says, is different.
Because a whole new tax law was put in place at the end of 2017.
That quick turnaround has Democrats worried that too little will be withheld, and Republicans will claim a middle-class tax cut, then saddle everyone with a big tax bill next year. The Trump administration said today those charges are, quote, ridiculous. John Myatt of payroll processor ADP says he's not too worried about the numbers being off.
I think IRS has taken a close look at this, and so I think they've accommodated as much as they can in what will be the 2018 withholding tables.
He says the bigger challenge is still ahead. Due to the new tax law, every worker in America will eventually have to submit a new W-4. You know the withholding form you fill out when you get a new job?
That's a substantial undertaking. Hundreds of millions of W-4s. filed with each employer that an individual might work for.
So, yay! More paperwork for everyone. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We told you earlier this week that federal energy regulators have rejected a Trump administration proposal to subsidize struggling nuclear and coal-fired energy plants. Now, a different but related story about how much, or even whether, really, subsidizing coal companies helps the people who live in coal country. Gwen Guilford went to Central Appalachia down near the West Virginia-Kentucky border to find out about that, and she wrote about it in Quartz. Gwen, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
We ought to say just at the get-go here that coal generates a lot of economic activity. Getting it out of the ground, sending it on, that's economic activity. What it does not do, though, is generate a whole lot of economic development, which is why now you have in Appalachia an almost mono-economic culture, right? There's no economic diversity.
Yes, that's exactly right. In fact, you talk to people in Central Appalachia and they call it a mono-economy or a monoculture, verbatim.
I thought I was coining a word there, but who knew? Who knew? Talk to me about this guy that you start the piece with, who got out, is really the deal.
Nick Mullins is a 38-year-old former coal miner. He's raised in a family where his dad's a coal miner, his uncles are all coal miners, and his family is all like, do not go into coal mining, just don't, because they've gone through the hardships. And he, you know, can't quite figure out how to get it together to go to college, even though he was like National Honor Society and stuff like that. So he, you know, sort of swallows his pride and like turns his back on his family's advice and gets a coal job. Hmm. And for a while, that's great. And he's making good money. His healthcare premiums are very minimal. And, you know, he's got a 401k plan. You know, this is middle class life. Coal is the only way to do that in most of Central Appalachia. And, you know, eventually he realizes, like, he does not want to be a coal miner for the rest of his life.
He eventually does get out, but his story brings up two points. One is that even though there are really few coal jobs in that area, there's only like 11,000 coal miners in all of West Virginia or something, you say. Those are the only jobs that can give you a decent wage. But also, the land is owned by people who are not vested in the community.
That's right. The land is not owned by people who are vested in the community. The upshot of all that is that, yeah, land, this crucial source of wealth, crucial source of, you know, intergenerational wealth, is incredibly scarce because of the vast, you know, tentacles of corporate ownership. So that makes it so other forms of potential wealth, like property, like small businesses, you know, struggle to thrive because there's simply no opportunity to, you know, build new anything.
When you ask these folks in this area of Central Appalachia what they think their future is now, the president who has promised to revive the coal industry, but with market forces who have decidedly different opinion, what do they say?
A lot of people are holding out hope that coal can be revived to some degree with the rollback of environmental regulations. But I didn't talk to anybody who, you know, was kind of hanging their hat on that.
Yeah.
What has happened in the region is like there are not obvious alternatives. It's not like, oh, but we have this other thing, so we'll just start investing in that. When you do this generation after generation after generation, you lose your good people. You know, there aren't great schools and there aren't good jobs to teach you new skills and there's not the know-how to really create new opportunities for people who don't want to do coal mining, as Nick's experience revealed.
Gwen Guilford writes in Quartz about economics, most recently the coal industry in Central Appalachia. Gwen, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
Nope. Would not buy them. Just regular eggs is good.
What you're buying when you buy organic. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 0.8%. Today, 205 points, 25,574. NASDAQ ain't 0.8%, about 58 points, 72.11. S&P 500 up 0.7%, 19 points, 27 and 67 there. Told you earlier about Walmart sharing its tax breaks by boosting wages and bonuses. On the news, Walmart up 0.3%. Target up 4.6% today. Big Lots boxed up about 1.5%. Airline stocks are doing fine. Thank you very much. Delta posted better than expected quarterly earnings. Said gains would continue through 2018. Shares soared 4.7% today. American Airlines flew up 4.9%. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note. Bond bear market? What bond bear market? Down. Yield was down 2.53%. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The new Marvel superhero movie Black Panther is breaking records, and it is not even out yet. Fandango says the first 24 hours of advanced ticket sales beat the sales for Captain America: Civil War, thus setting a new bar for Marvel. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath reports the studio has been promoting the movie a ton, but there has also been a whole lot of grassroots support.
Alex Sagawa writes and tweets about black nerd culture under her secret identity, Clarkeisha Kent. I asked her, just how overdue is this movie?
Yeah, super, super, super overdue.
She says black people see themselves represented in this film in a way no movie has done in decades. Instead of a black sidekick, it's got a black director, all black cast, and black superhero star.
He's super smart, super capable, super rich, and, you know, super black too.
Disney, which owns Marvel Studios, has given the film a solid marketing push. The first trailer aired during the NBA Finals last summer, and a new one aired Monday during college football playoffs. Projections have Black Panther breaking $1 billion in sales. A lot of those are being driven by social media and word of mouth. People across the country are setting up watch parties and making a thing out of it.
I wanted to give kids in Harlem the opportunity to go see Black Panther, who otherwise may have never had the opportunity.
Frederick Joseph set up a GoFundMe campaign to buy tickets and refreshments for kids from the Harlem Boys and Girls Club. He figured he'd raise a few $1,000s, with any excess going to the club.
Last I checked, we were at $35,000.
GoFundMe enjoyed his campaign so much, they set up a Black Panther challenge, where the first 10 copycat campaigns would get $100. Joseph says there are now 45 similar groups around the country. As for his own viewing plans, he's been so busy with the campaign, he forgot to buy tickets. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
We, like a lot of news outfits, get books. A whole lot of books. A good portion of them, naturally, given what we do, business books, self-help books, management books. And the truth is, the titles all kind of run together. Between the buzzwords and all the blandishments, it gets very confusing. Data journalist Miriam Quick analyzed those titles, the words used in them specifically, going back a couple of decades to see how things have changed, and then she wrote about it for the BBC. Miriam, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Tell me why you decided to look at this stuff.
Well, the original impetus for the article, which was published on the BBC Capital website, actually just came from chatting with my editor, Kieran, about the number of business books that are just sitting on his colleagues' desks with titles that seem to promise the reader health or wealth or eternal happiness. So these are really business books, but they're also self-help books. Yeah. They're aimed at the kind of people who want to succeed in the workplace, or maybe they're entrepreneurs, or maybe they just want to improve their productivity or their performance at work.
Give me the quick once-over on your methodology. You sort of broke it down by time, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we kind of noticed that they all seem to use the same pool of buzzwords or phrases. So things like unlock your potential or turbocharge your productivity or use breakthrough strategies to transform the ordinary into the extraordinary. And we thought, are there any patterns here? Maybe there are some changes over time in terms of which buzzwords are more popular in certain decades. Do they go in and out of fashion? So those are really my research questions.
There was a constant, right? The constant is business. That showed up in all the word clouds that you built. I was struck by the changes in the use in how people refer to small businesses, right? They used to be small businesses and now they're startups. I just thought that was kind of revelatory.
Exactly, yeah. That was one of the more interesting changes. And also, quite interestingly, the words men and women only appeared in more recent business books. So I guess you can put that down to a greater awareness of maybe workplace gender issues.
It's interesting that no matter what they do, they all promise those same things that you started with, right? It's all about get yourself wealthier, get yourself healthier, get yourself someplace better than the place you are now.
Right, yeah, that's exactly it. They're very, very aspirational. On the other hand, some words do seem to be becoming less popular over time. So there's this move away from what you might call traditional business terminology. That's words like strategy, management, leadership, or even market, which maybe sounds too neutral or impersonal for the more modern brand of business books, which tend to be quite individualistic, you know, quite psychologically driven. There's less talk of markets and strategy, and it's more about dreams and mindset and finding your passion.
Once you were done with all of this data analysis, what was your takeaway? What did you leave thinking?
It's all about hype, you know. Performance is not just satisfactory. It's always outstanding. You don't just have an important goal. You have a wildly important goal. Although I do think it's quite interesting that there's signs of a backlash at the moment. So there's even a book called The Art of Failure. You know, most books are about success, but this one's about the art of failure, and it's called The Anti-Self-Help Guide. So the main thing they do is tell you to ignore self-help books and just do what you're doing anyway, which I quite like the sound of.
Miriam Quick wrote about self-help and business books and the buzzwords thereof for the BBC. Miriam, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Customers who buy organic, generally speaking, pay more, and they do it generally happily, or at least willingly. But what exactly are they paying for? When it comes to livestock and poultry in particular, there are some gray areas. The Trump administration is trying to kill off an Obama-era rule that would have required organic-certified egg-laying chickens to actually get some time outside. Julie Grant from the environmental reporting outlet Allegheny Front has that story.
There are so many types of eggs in the cooler at this Ohio supermarket. Free range, cage free, organic.
Nope. Would not buy them. Just regular eggs is good.
Retired factory worker Judy Wells chooses a big 18 egg carton from the bottom row. But Rachel Goodrich is willing to pay more than a dollar extra for a half carton, just six, because they're organic eggs. One thing she expects from the organic label is that the animals will be treated well.
I'm a big animal lover. I think it's worth spending an extra few dollars.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture administers the National Organic Program. For eggs to be certified, the hens must be fed organic feed and can't be given antibiotics. There's no plan to change that. But the organic industry has debated an animal welfare rule for years. So last January, as President Obama was leaving office, the USDA issued a new rule. It says organic egg producers must allow their chickens to spend time outdoors and defines what an outdoor space should look like. And it's something like this hen house in rural eastern Ohio. It's set up a bit like seating in a small stadium. Along the top row are nests where the chickens lay eggs. When temperatures get above 40 degrees, the family that runs this farm opens a series of rectangular doors.
This is a door where they go out.
23-year-old Marie Erb runs this operation with her husband.
This latch I always have open during the summertime when I'm letting them out.
They can go out as they please.
The Erbs are part of a group of about 30 family farms in the region that produce eggs distributed to supermarkets in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states. It's organized by Pete and Jerry's Organic Eggs, based in New Hampshire, which sees the new animal treatment rule as an important clarification to the organic standards. Jesse LaFlamme is Pete and Jerry's CEO. He says without the change, a few producers can tarnish the organic industry. He gives the example of Herbrook's Poultry Ranch, a major egg supplier with a huge farm in Michigan. It's added something called poultry porches to the barns.
And they've tacked a little tiny porch on the side of them where a fraction of the hens in those barns might be able to go out at one time if they could actually find their way to it.
Poultry porches are currently allowed under organic standards, but that would change with the new rule. Herbrooks declined an interview for this story, but it pointed to comments on the rule by the National Assembly of State Animal Health Officials that says poultry porches help protect birds so they aren't vulnerable to predators and disease. Caitlin McCulloch is with the American Farm Bureau Federation, a group that lobbies on behalf of farmers and ranchers. Her organization wants the rule withdrawn because it could prevent some of her members from using the valuable organic label.
Many farmers and ranchers had already invested in the organic system and made some substantial changes to how they did things just to transition to organic, and that this would be an additional hoop to jump through, and that might not all be possible for all organic producers.
But the Organic Trade Association supports the rule and says it balances the expectations of organic consumers with the realities of commercial livestock and poultry production. The group points out that the rule took 10 years to create. It's suing the USDA for failing to put the rule into action. In Sugar Creek, Ohio, I'm Julie Grant for Marketplace.
You want to know more about federal rules and regulations and this economy? Come on, you know you do. Check out season 2 of our podcast. It's called The Uncertain Hour. Regulations are the topic du jour. Final note on the way out today, courtesy of Eamon Javers at CNBC. This morning, at the end of one of those press pool things the president is increasingly doing on camera, he was asked about his physical that is coming up tomorrow and whether he thought it was going to go well. Here's the presidential quote. This one's a clean one, not the other one you've been reading about this afternoon. It better go well, the president said of his physical, quote, otherwise the stock market will not be happy, end of quote. Thing is, he's not wrong. Oh boy, look at the time we got to go. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.